Information is free.
The law.
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
Tonight, we care.
Appear to border on
the
fence.
The law.
The country.
Whether you went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the 140th episode of MediaMonarchy.com. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show, and it's September 11th, 2009. 8 years later, the day that everything changed. On this special episode, we've got 9/11/09 in the bigger picture, Van Jones and the left-right battle over 9/11, Giuliani and re-education, Trade Center wreckage, remembering Beverly Eckert, and all the current 9/11 updates, plus 11 points of contention with the official story of 9/11. It's all here on the 8th anniversary. It's episode 140, it's 9/11/09, and this is MediaMonarchy.com.
The leaves of brown came tumbling down, remember, in September. In the rain, the sun went out just like a dying ember, that September. In the rain, to every word of love I heard you whisper, the raindrops seem to play a sweet refrain. Though spring is here, to me it's still September. That September in the rain. To every word of love I heard you, the raindrops seem to play a sweet refrain. Though spring is here, to me it's still September, that September in the rain. I felt that September in the rain.
September in the Rain. That's an oldie but a goodie from Dinah Washington. And I didn't realize how fitting that song would be when I chose it a couple days ago for today's show. Because on this morning in New York, cold rain mixed with tears as mourners collected under umbrellas and a dreary sky Friday to mark the 8th anniversary of the September 11th attacks with old rituals and a new purpose, honoring the spirit of those who rushed forward to help. My friends, welcome to the 140th episode of MediaMonarchy.com. It's September 11th, 2009, 8 years later. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the radio show and website known as MediaMonarchy.com. And we're coming to you live, as always, every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific Time on the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org. And again, this couldn't be possible without the growing list of great internet and low-power FM affiliates that rebroadcast Media Monarchy. Two of them do it live, and that's ZeroPointRadio.com. They also blast it out low-power FM style on 92.3 in Casper, Wyoming. Also, thanks to the worldwide home of free speech, RevereRadio.net, playing the show live. And it's 1 p.m. on the East Coast right now. Also, thanks to Free Radio Olympia, Boulder Free Radio, Ground Zero Radio in Canton, Georgia, Berkeley Liberation Radio.net, and Cascadia Public Radio.org. If you're new to the show, I welcome you. This is a special show. I may not get it all right. I may get choked up over my words. When I was listening to that song and I was bringing up the story posted by the Associated Press 2 hours ago about cold rain mixed with tears, and I see some photos, it already got me. Put quite simply, the events of 8 years ago today have had the most massive ramifications that I can imagine. And I've told this before, but I can tell it again shortly, that 8 years ago, I was in my next to last semester of college in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. I was working at a bar, so I worked late and slept late. I only had a few classes left. On Tuesday morning, September 11th, 2001, I overslept. My roommate, Rose, finally, at around 10 o'clock or so, came and banged on my door. I got out of bed and stumbled to the door in my boxers and opened the door, and she's crying and said, "You gotta wake up. You gotta turn on the TV." She said something that didn't make any sense about New York and Trade Center blown up. I turned on the radio to WSHC, the radio station for the school that I worked for, and it wasn't us broadcasting. There was something on that channel, but it wasn't us. So that was the first red flag. Changed the channels a little bit. Something's up. Got my gear together. Headed over to the media building where the radio station is. That's kind of the center. It's kind of always been that way for me. In good times and bad times, the radio station is the thing I'm going to come back to or run to. So I went, checked out a video camera. I shot a lot of video. I've never looked at it or listened to it to this day. I'm sure it's footage of me talking into the camera, holding back tears, saying, "Can't get a hold of my brother in Manhattan. Can't get a hold of my friend Joey in D.C. I have no idea what's going on. None of the phones are working. Things have blown up. I don't really know what's going on. Planes hit the towers and they fell down." We all wandered around town that day with everybody kind of a glazed, shocked look on their face. And was up for most of the day and probably through the night, probably ultimately just drank myself to sleep to be able to go to sleep. Long story short, over the next few years, I started to investigate 9/11 on my own. And my initial question was very simple. As a media junkie, movie, film, TV, radio, I loved it all, I want it. The question hit me of, what's the video look like of the plane hitting the Pentagon? I wanted to see it. We can't see it. We've never seen it. We've only seen a few frames that show nothing. And other scratchy surveillance videos that have been squeezed out over these 8 years. Once I found out I couldn't see the Pentagon footage, that essentially sent me down the rabbit hole. And saw the work of folks like Dave Von Kleist or Alex Jones, And it was all essentially about the events of that day and the towers and the suspicious nature of their collapse and essentially the ballistics, if you will. So over those few years, I studied and I kept it to myself and I didn't really talk about it all that much. Flash forward to 2005. I move out of Shepherdstown, move across the country to Portland, Oregon. I feel like I had done enough study that I felt confident to try and put some information back out to the world. And on September 11th, 2005, 4 years ago today, I started MediaMonarchy.com. It's my way of working through what we saw. And so many things surround all this. I'm not going to go over every detail. I perhaps wouldn't be able to sway you. If you're a new listener, perhaps a friend who is skeptical of questions about the official story of 9/11, I may not be able to sway you right here, but we're going to go over so much information that if even half of what I say is true, this merits further research on your behalf. And what I try and do is give you the ability to go do more research for yourself. I don't try to tell you what to believe. I sometimes am working out what I think. And again, I don't want you to believe something. Like you have faith in some God you can't see. We want to talk about facts, and we want to talk about names, and we want to talk about documents and things written down. Throughout the generations, multi-generational serial killers ultimately have seized control through one way or another, and it exists to this day. They fund both sides. They hit their own gang. They perform coups and false flag attacks, acting like the attacks are being carried out by someone else to blame an enemy you want to start a war with. I don't spend a lot of time theorizing and postulating about what exactly went down, and that's one of the erroneous arguments, again, that people will make. Well, what happened then? And I have to create some airtight case. All I know is the official story can't be true. And we're going to get into that in the last half of the show with what I call 11 points of contention with the official story of 9/11. However, what we want to do before we get to the overview is we want to look at what's going on right now. 9/11 still exists to this day as an event, as an idea, as a meme, as a scare tactic, as a blank check that lets us do everything we're still doing to this day with our new president. And if we glance at Google News right now on this 9/11/09 morning, we see from Reuters 48 minutes ago, Obama says U.S. must renew fight against al-Qaeda, echoing the same rhetoric of the previous puppet. This is not change. Do you get it? I had the extreme pleasure yesterday of conducting a 2.5-hour interview with Richard Andrew Grove of TragedyAndHope.com. He was the man behind the 9/11 Synchronicity podcast and, put quite simply, a big inspiration for Media Monarchy, the radio show. That interview is going to go up after this episode 140. So today, dropping major info war bombs. It's going to be 5-plus hours of new, alternative, original media coming from MediaMonarchy.com, episode 139B, episode 140, and an interview with Richard Andrew Grove of TragedyAndHope.com. Let's listen to just a quick clip of my conversation with Richard.
Well, there might be people in your audience who say, well, you know, I don't believe in conspiracies. I still don't believe you. I've read these books. I don't believe you. Well, here's a Fire in the Minds of Men, Origins of the Revolutionary Faith by James H. Billington, who was not only a Librarian of Congress, but he's also a Rhodes Scholar. And let's see what he talks about in here. Oh, he's talking about the Masons and different fraternities and secret societies and, oh, the occult origins of organization. So he's basically saying all the organizations, including, you know, Bavarian Illuminism and Freemasonry and the other things he's talking about in his great big thick book, all exist, and, you know, only people who don't know about it are the victims, because victims don't read books. And that's kind of how you determine if you're a victim or not. Are you reading their books and understanding and bypassing their shell game, or are you playing into it every day, right? Because, you know, we're allowed to maintain these beliefs about, you know, what we think America is because of the media companies. But look, you know, in March 1915, this is a statement by U.S. Congressman Oscar Calloway in 1917. And he states, in March 1915, the J.P. Morgan interests, the steel, shipbuilding, and powder interests, that means they make powder for war, and their subsidiary organizations got together 12 men high up in the newspaper world and employed them to select the most influential newspapers in the United States and sufficient number of them to control generally the policy of the daily press. They found it was necessary to purchase control of only 25 of the greatest newspapers. An agreement was reached, the policy of the papers was bought to be paid for by the month as a subscription. An editor was furnished for each paper to properly supervise and edit information regarding the questions of preparedness, militarism, financial policies, and other things of national and international nature considered vital to the interest of the purchasers.
This leads us directly into talking about what we're stewing in today, and whether it's public relations or media control. I wanted to make a reference as we were speaking about what is referred to, I believe, as corporate personhood. One of the few places I think I've ever really seen this discussed in any kind of mainstream avenue was, I believe, the documentary The Corporation, which, if memory serves correct, uses as its jumping off point the idea that, and it introduced this idea and this fact that what you said, those two sentences, made corporations like a person. Is what kind of person would that corporation be if you could lay that person down on an analyst couch? What kind of person would they be if you sort of looked them over? And they would ultimately be a sociopath, because they act with complete disregard for anyone else, don't seem to learn from their mistakes, and on and on. And on. They would be a dick. They would be a nut. They would be someone you wouldn't want to hang out with.
You definitely wouldn't want them feeding, clothing, educating your children. It's corporate psychopathy. The way corporations are programmed in the operating systems that are the legal documents of that corporation, it is mandated to profit at all costs and to return a profit to the shareholders. And that's it. It doesn't matter if they poison you. It doesn't matter if they kill the environment. Global warming doesn't matter. And in order to fix that, ironically enough, there was an attorney who spent 23 years working for Skadden Arps. His name's Robert Hinckley. He's now retired. And he saw the error of his ways and saw that lawyers are really what's behind all of these little nuances that we can't figure out. Because he said, if we were to change the corporate mandate, corporate law, and you put these additional 26 words in, it says corporations must profit, but not at the expense of human or environmental suffering, et cetera, et cetera. These 26 words would directly, because it's an operating system, change the behavior of all these corporations, because at the end of the day, it is greed. There is some evil going on, but it's also just how the corporations are set up to run, because the people who created these corporations years ago and the mandates said, hey, let's make the corporations act as sociopaths so we can use them as proxies, and the people who hide above those corporations and use those corporations against us would be protected and would never meet the guillotine.
That's just a little hors d'oeuvre of my 2.5 hour conversation with Richard Andrew Grove of TragedyAndHope.com. And what we essentially did in that talk is not so much go over the minutia of September 11th. Very little actually gets into 9/11. What we really try and do is go over the body of history that predates 9/11 by decades and even centuries. And what we go over is what we just heard: corporate control, psychopathy. So my friends, I implore you, I'm asking you to get that interview and to spread it out, as well as other episodes of Media Monarchy. Someone Richard and I mention a few times during that conversation is my man James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. His most recent episode, number 97, 9/11/09 and the bigger picture, where he wrote last Sunday, with the 8th anniversary of 9/11 fast approaching, the Corbett Report steps back to take stock of what has been learned from the 9/11 truth movement and where things might go from here. We've already taken a look at the software, the drills, the intelligence connections, and the stifled investigations that have defined the bigger picture of 9/11, but how does this connect to the suppressed history that we uncover week in and week out? Essentially, what he's saying is, this is bigger than 9/11. And we've known that all along. 9/11 is just the key to open the door of all this other hidden bodies of history. As always, I would recommend checking out Corbett Report. He's now being played on ZeroPointRadio.com. He's also recently back from a vacation, and he's also been cranking out new videos. He's got an interview with activist Nathan Moulton about his activist, the movie. There's an interview also with John Williams, economist, statistician from shadowstats.com, and it's part two from Corbett Report's Economics 101, and in this installment they go over the real unemployment statistics. So again, episode 97 from Corbett Report, 9/11/09, and the bigger picture. And again, thanks to the hard work of folks like Richard Grove and James Corbett. Let's look at the day before 9/11/01. Let's look at one of the more interesting stories that surrounded the day before everything changed. Brass Check TV notes that people right now are all up in arms about all these bailouts, but they're giveaways, really, petty. They're forgetting about the perhaps biggest giveaway of all time. $2.3 trillion missing, gone, no explanation from the Spentagon.
Pentagon, the day before 9/11, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld declared war. Not on foreign terrorists.
The adversary is closer to home. It's the Pentagon bureaucracy.
He said money wasted by the military poses a serious threat.
In fact, it could be said that it's a matter of life and death.
Rumsfeld promised change. But the next day, the world changed. And in the rush to fund the war on terrorism, the war on waste seems to have been forgotten.
My 03 budget calls for more than $48 billion in new defense spending.
More money for the Pentagon when its own auditors admit the military cannot account for 25% of what it already spends.
According to some estimates, we cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
$2.3 trillion with a T. That's $8,000 for every man, woman, and child in America. To understand how the Pentagon can lose track of trillions, consider the case of one military accountant who tried to find out what happened to a mere 300 million.
We know it's gone, but we don't know what they're standing on.
Jim Minnery, a former Marine turned whistleblower, is risking his job by speaking out for the first time about the millions he noticed were missing from one defense agency's balance sheets. Minnery tried to follow the money trail, even crisscrossing the country looking for records.
The director looked at me and said, "Why do you care about this stuff?" It took me aback. You know, my supervisor asked me why I care about doing a good job.
He was reassigned and says officials then covered up the problem by just writing it off.
They got to cover it up. That's where the corruption comes in. They got to cover up the fact that they can't do jobs.
The Pentagon's inspector general partially substantiated several of Minnery's allegations, but could not prove official tried to manipulate the financial statements. 20 years ago, Pentagon employee Franklin C. Spinney made headlines exposing what he calls the accounting game. He's still there, and although he does not speak for the Pentagon, he believes the problem has gotten worse.
Those numbers are pie in the sky. The books are cooked routinely year after year after year.
Retired Vice Admiral Jack Shanahan commanded the Navy's Second Fleet the first time Donald Rumsfeld served as Defense Secretary.
With good financial oversight, we could find the $48 billion in loose change in that building without having to hit the taxpayers.
In the 2.5 minutes since this report began, the Pentagon has spent nearly $2 million, and it may never know where 25% of those tax dollars went. In Los Angeles, I'm Vince Gonzalez for Eye on America.
Loose change indeed. That's from CBS News. And for the first time in this episode, but there will be many more to follow, we're going to hop over to the complete 9/11 timeline thanks to HistoryCommons.org. September 10th, 2001, Rumsfeld announces Defense Department cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions. In a speech to the Department of Defense, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld announces that the Department of Defense, quote, cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions. CBS later calculates that 25% of the yearly defense budget is unaccounted for and quotes a longtime defense budget analyst saying, quote, their numbers are pie in the sky. The books are cooked routinely year after year. Coverage of this rather shocking story is nearly non-existent given the events of the next day. We have sources to the Department of Defense and CBS News. In April 2002, it will be revealed that $1.1 trillion of the missing money comes from the 2000 fiscal year. Auditors won't even quantify how much money is missing from fiscal year 2001, causing some to fear it's worse than the year before. The Department of the Army will state that it won't publish a standalone financial statement for 2001 because of the loss of financial management personnel sustained during the September 11th terrorist attack. The $1.1 trillion-plus unknown additional amounts continues to remain unaccounted for, and auditors say it may take 8 years of reorganization before a proper accounting can be done. Further source to InsightMag.com. Now, I've mentioned that I set up my Facebook.com/MediaMonarchy to import the feed from my website. And I get a strange mix of folks I went to elementary school with and folks I went to college with and folks who are fans of Media Monarchy all kind of mixing around together, and it's a funny thing to see. Someone I literally went to grade school with and haven't seen in 15-plus years commented when I posted this up essentially saying, why would you post this? I want the whole story. What's this about? Just little bits and pieces. I'm in the military. I would have known something about this. So I just hit up the link, sent them to the Department of Defense and CBS News. That pretty much ended the debate, and they more or less demurred and said, how are you doing? That's what we have to do. We have to hit documents. We have to hit facts. And again, I don't have all the answers, but I couldn't try and chart a course through this. And again, with the help of others and with your help, we can all do it and teach each other how to do it better and effectively communicate what's really going down. Donald Rumsfeld didn't sneak out the back door with $2.3 trillion in his back pocket. It's not what we're saying. Bush didn't knock down the towers. It's not what we're saying. Trillions missing from the Pentagon should give you a little glimpse through the keyhole into the military-industrial complex, something Eisenhower warned about. Something that has infiltrated every level of our consumer culture lives. Check out a book called The Complex. But I digress. Further into new 9/11 news. This is an interesting one. This is a story that got a lot of headlines, but they missed the point. Van Jones resigns as Enviro Czar over 9/11 truth statement. This from the Los Angeles Times. This coming from last Saturday, September 5th. Van Jones, the one-time Marxist whose controversial statements about Republicans and 9/11 have made him a distracting lightning rod as Obama's environmental czar in recent days, resigned Saturday night. So, of course, Sunday talk shows had all kinds of things to talk about. On the previous Wednesday, LA Times also reported Jones was forced to apologize when a video surfaced of his February remarks in Berkeley, of all places, using a reference to a lower anatomical orifice to describe Republicans. The next day, Jones again had to apologize for having his signature on a petition to then New York Attorney General Elliot Spitzer seeking an investigation into the 9/11 attacks as possibly an inside job planned by then President George W. Bush to soften opposition to a war in Iraq. We can hit the link and go to 911truth.org and see a copy of that petition. But it doesn't want to load, but that doesn't matter, because essentially there's all kinds of other people on that list. Crazy people like Ed Asner. But ultimately, what we need to remember about all this is that the majority of Americans question 9/11. This further goes down the hall and this swirls around with the talking heads and Glenn Beck, and they're going to get everything they can on all of Obama's advisors, which I would say isn't necessarily a bad thing, but again, they're doing it from the phony conservative reactionary right. They're not hitting Obama where it counts, on the left. But of course, Glenn Beck promises this is just the beginning. I would support exposing Cass Sunstein. Interestingly enough, one of the main writers over at Raw Story, Stephen Webster, has his own blog called The Webster Report, and he weighed in on Van Jones and 9/11, and all I'll say here is that Stephen Webster of Raw Story says, quote, "I have no answers. All I have is doubt. My only conclusion is to question." As we've noted many times here before, that it's always seemed like the folks at RawStory.com are closet 9/11 truthers. The last note on this Van Jones posting comes from Sander Hicks. This relates to a conference I believe he's putting on in New York this weekend. You can go to WeDemandTransparency.com for more on that. Trying to bring the truth, quote-unquote, movements together with the peace, quote-unquote, movements. The last thing I'll say is I pointed out this Van Jones story to a lot of folks at work. Some hadn't heard of it. Some of them who, of course, always seemed to be paying attention to politics when it was election time, now, of course, have gone back to sleep because the bandwagon's over. Yay, we got our guy in. Now I can go back to bed. In a way, sort of burying the lead, a lot of the newspaper articles didn't point out that this is pretty much about 9/11 truth. And that's a good thing. We need to make more things about 9/11 truth. I want to hit now a post that I had posted up last week. It was towards the end of the episode, but it was something we ran out of time, and of course it's fitting that I just saved it for this episode. So originally posted September 2nd on MediaMonarchy.com, 9/11 updates, no New York, 93 memorial, and mystery aircraft. One note I will make quickly. Again, as I said on the B-side just a little bit ago, as we noted the breaking news of an anti-abortion activist shot and killed at a Michigan high school, sketchy details at this point, we also now see the story just now breaking at the top of Google News, training exercise on Potomac creates media frenzy. Intercepted radio traffic about a Coast Guard training exercise in the Potomac River led to erroneous television news reports that shots had been fired on a recreational boat Friday, a senior Coast Guard official said. The news reports generated uncertainty that prompted D.C. police officials to respond to the scene and the Federal Aviation Administration, to temporarily ground planes at Reagan National Airport. We will keep an eye on this story. Returning to the updates. More on the recent National Geographic special, 9/11, Science and Conspiracy, which is essentially a media war on those crazy conspiracy theorists, marginalizing 9/11 truth, of course brought to you by the fine folks such as Rupert Murdoch and the Central Intelligence Agency and Operation Mockingbird and the mighty Wurlitzer. But we noted from Politico last week that Obama is going to spend the 9/11 anniversary in Virginia. He's there. He laid a wreath at the Pentagon. No New York for Obama's first 9/11. Quick headline and something that relates, I believe, to that National Geographic special. Recent Psychology Today piece calls conspiracy thinking a quote-unquote psychotic illness. But the rebuttal to that is why psychologists are infinitely more dangerous than conspiracy theorists. Who's harmed more people? Psychologists, psychopathy, big pharma, or crazy conspiracy theorists? From CNN, federal government to buy land for Flight 93 Memorial, Pennsylvania landowners around the 9/11 crash site of Flight 93 have reached an agreement with the federal government allowing construction of a permanent memorial there. U.S. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar said the National Park Service has reached agreements with all the landowners needed to establish the permanent memorial for the 40 people killed in the terrorist hijacking 8 years ago. Salazar said the government will pay the landowners approximately $9.5 million. Hoodwinked in Shanksville. A quick headline from our own PortlandTribune.com, 9/11 memorial stolen from St. Helens Park in Oregon. But a little more serious and in-depth from 911blogger.com, just one of the myriad stories of suspicious events surrounding 8 years ago today. Bobcats over Washington on 9/11. What were two mystery aircraft doing overhead the Pentagon? Two military aircraft were flying at high altitude near the Pentagon around the time it was hit on 9/11, but the identities of these aircraft and what they were doing over the Pentagon are unknown. The planes had the call signs Bobcat 14 and Bobcat 17. A partial transcript of air traffic controller communications revealed they were communicating with the control tower at Reagan National, which is less than a mile from the Pentagon, between 9:31 and 9:40 on 9/11. The attack on the Pentagon took place at 9:37 a.m. Radar data has shown that the two aircraft flew, quote-unquote, in trail. That would be in single file with one directly behind the other at an altitude of 21,000 feet and were overhead in the few minutes before the Pentagon was hit. It would seem essential to establish the exact identities of these aircraft and find out what they were doing in the vicinity of the Pentagon at such a critical time, yet 8 years after the attacks took place, we still don't have this info. The fact that these aircraft were near the Pentagon at the time it was hit, is itself virtually unknown. According to a 9/11 Commission memorandum, quote, flight strips and other information, end quote, indicate that the two aircraft, Bobcat 14 and 17, quote, originated out of Dover Air Force Base in Delaware. The memo added, it is possible, but not confirmed, that they were Air Force corporate passenger jets. When questioned by the 9/11 Commission, Bob Lazar, the acting operations manager at Reagan Airport on 9/11, said he, quote, did not remember any aircraft with the call sign Bobcat that hung out over the national airspace. All he could say is that he did remember two aircraft coming from the north, but he did not think that they entered National's airspace, Reagan National Airport. Furthermore, there were at least two other military aircraft near the Pentagon at the time it was hit, a C-130 cargo plane that took off from Andrews Air Force Base, 10 miles from the Pentagon, airborne by 9:33, seen by numerous witnesses above the Pentagon just after the attack. Its pilot reportedly witnessed the explosion from the Pentagon crash. And television news reporters described a white jet plane that was circling the White House a few minutes after the Pentagon was hit. The White House, 3 miles from the Pentagon. Two government sources familiar with the incident later told CNN that the plane was a military aircraft, but its details were classified. An analysis by CNN suggested the aircraft was an E-4B, which is a militarized version of a Boeing 747 that is used as a flying command post. One such aircraft is known to have taken off from an airfield outside D.C. shortly before the Pentagon was hit. Considering the historical significance of the 9/11 attacks, which have had such devastating consequences that affect us to this day, It's essential that important details surrounding those attacks be thoroughly investigated. We therefore need to know exactly what the two aircraft, Bobcat 14 and Bobcat 17, were, and why were they flying above the Pentagon around the time it was attacked on 9/11. This article, thankfully, has source notes, PDFs, documents, memorandums, radar-based timelines, and maps. Do the research. Film critic criticizes Tarantino over his 9/11 remark from Examiner.com. They note that a theater critic, it's a movie critic named Johan Hari, who's a columnist for the London Independent, has criticized movie director Quentin Tarantino for making this statement about 9/11 not long after it happened. Quote, "It didn't affect me because there's like a Hong Kong action movie called Purple Storm and they work in a whole big thing in the plot and they blow up a skyscraper." The film critic essentially said that this is a case study in atrophy of moral senses. To brag that you weren't moved by the murder of 2,500 actual people because you'd already seen it in a simulated movie. Only somebody who has never seen violence, who sees the world as made of celluloid, can respond like this. Desensitized. Outrage after ad shows 9/11 attacks with dozens of planes. This from Raw Story. A television ad made by the Brazilian unit of ad agency DBB made its rounds on the internet last Wednesday, sparking outrage from viewers and the organization the ad was originally supposed to be for, the World Wildlife Fund, WWF. The ad shows a graphical recreation of 9/11 followed by an additional scenario showing dozens of planes descending on Manhattan. It surfaced after winning a non-profit award. The tagline says the tsunami killed 100 times more people than 9/11. The planet is brutally powerful. Respect it. Preserve it. We're just utterly appalled, WWF spokeswoman Leslie Ahn told the New York Daily News last Wednesday. This ad is not something that anyone in our organization would have ever signed off on. DBB Brazil said the team that made the ad, produced late last year, is no longer with the company. There's been more fallout. You can still find the clip. I do have it linked up. We'll get to it in a little bit in an update headline. The video is being squashed quickly each time it pops up on YouTube, so when you get it, save it, share it. And I see that, again, we've gotten a bit of updates. The last note here on this posting from September 2nd, the last note is that Van Jones, Obama's green advisor's past, stirs trouble for the White House at a critical time. Appropriately enough, that's from Fox News on September 3rd. Those are some 9/11 updates. No New York, 93 Memorial, and mystery aircraft. Now, however, it's time for newer updates, posted September 10th, 2009, past, present, and future. We first note, Safe America announces national drill down for 9/11. These would be terror tests for pandemic preparedness. We have reports from WTOP.com, as well as a cache of the PDF of the press release from the Safe America Foundation announcing a plan to conduct a series of drills across the country today, 9/11/09, in an attempt to heighten grassroots preparedness by individuals and families. The effort, spearheaded by a coalition of nonprofit agencies, which Safe America has formed, will focus on getting individuals to pledge to practice how they'd respond to an emergency situations with their families on 9/11 today. It's called Drill Down for Safety. And all your favorite friends are involved. UPS, Motorola, Office Depot, Booz Allen Hamilton, Allstate, FEMA, Red Cross, NEMA, Government Communications, EMTs, all kinds of alphabet agencies. The drills, the drills, the drills. We watch the drills. Why do we watch the drills? Well, again, we return to History Commons, not only historycommons.org, but also their blog, hcgroups.wordpress.com. 9/11 drill for simulated plane crash 5 minutes before the Pentagon attack. Again, we're at the Pentagon, where Obama's Messiah was today. 5 minutes before the Pentagon was hit on September 11, 2001, a training exercise being run by a U.S. intelligence agency just over 20 miles from the Pentagon was set to include the scenario of a small private jet plane crashing into a building. It's unclear whether the scenario was played out or if the exercise had been called off by that time. Important details of the exercise, which was being conducted by the National Reconnaissance Office, NRO, at its headquarters in Chantilly, Virginia, are revealed in a document obtained by the 9/11 Commission. The document titled, Early Morning Flight Activity, September 11th, 2001. This was part of a series of 9/11 Commission records moved to the U.S. National Archives at the start of this year. The AP revealed that no real plane was going to be used in the exercise, and the crash was to be the result of mechanical failure, not terrorism. We can hit the link and hit the entry. Again, over to the complete 9/11 timeline with sources to the National Law Enforcement and Security Institute, United Press International, Associated Press, where they note that a 9/11-style simulation canceled. And again, this source is back to the National Reconnaissance Office. Good news, good news, good news. NYCCAN.org, New York City CAN, submitted another 28,000 signatures for their 9/11 investigation ballot initiative. Some of the obstructions have been dropped. So from 9/11 blogger, as well as Manny Badillo, 9/11 activists out of New York, they've announced the petition is going to go forward. It looks like the ballot initiative for a new investigation is going to be on the ballot this fall in New York. This is what we want. Provided, of course, we can have people under oath and subpoenaed. Actual power. Kurt Sonnenfeld. He was a FEMA photographer on 9/11 and the weeks thereafter. He's blown the whistle. And his story is a large and disturbing one. We'll briefly cover it. From VoltaireNet.org. As official videographer for the U.S. government, Kurt Sonnenfeld was detailed to Ground Zero on September 11, 2001, where he spent 1 month filming 29 tapes. Quote, what I saw at certain moments and in certain places is very disturbing. He never handed the tapes over to the authorities and has been persecuted ever since. Kurt Sonnenfeld lives in exile in Argentina, where he wrote a book called The Persecuted. It's not in English yet. There is an amazing exclusive interview from the Voltaire Network. Kurt Sonnenfeld's wife allegedly committed suicide. Kurt had been harassed and harangued, and he ran away to Argentina, and he's written a book called The Persecuted, and he's talking. Let's see the tapes. Put the tapes up. Oh, our good Left Gatekeeper Foundation-funded friends over at Huffington Post, where the main mouthpiece, Ariana Huffington, says, quote, I despise 9/11 truthers. This, of course, all relating to the Van Jones furor. Working towards 2013 opening for a 9/11 museum, that's from Newsday. We have also got a nice flashback to ABC News from July 2006, where I call it the ABCs of numerology. They note, gee, it's strange that all these attacks happen. New York, 9/11. Madrid, 3/11. Mumbai was 7/11. The numerology, the numbers game. This relates. New York City buildings graft shocker. Mob tied building inspectors in bribe and drug scandal. This from the New York Post. At least six city building inspectors, some with ties to powerful crime families, were videotaped taking bribes at a construction site, and some were even dealing coke and prescription pills while on duty. The corrupt Department of Building workers who lined their pockets by ignoring violations or expediting construction and building work permits They'll also be arrested later this month, along with about two dozen Lucchese crime family captains, soldiers, and associates. This all grew out of a 2007 New Jersey case involving a Lucchese faction that ran a staggering $2 billion a year gambling op and supplied drugs and cell phones to Bloods gang members in state prisons. That probe, which netted 32 wise guys, soon spread across the Hudson into the family's Big Apple hierarchy, prompting surveillance and wiretapping by the NYPD and Manhattan District Attorney Robert Morgenthau's office. This will be the latest scandal to rock the city's Department of Buildings, which is still reeling from its failures at the doomed Deutsche Bank Tower that contributed to the deaths of two city firefighters in August 2007. We've got a nice little cartoon from Gary Trudeau at Doonesbury slamming those crazy conspiracy theorists. The only thing that can counter them are the reasonists. It's a nice little inside joke and a pat on the back of people. You're so smart that you don't believe in those crazy conspiracy theories. Last several headlines here. Past, present, and future 9/11 anniversary updates. I would call this Islamanoia. There's an article on DeseretNews.com. Is another 9/11 set to unfold? And again, we've seen Obama beating the same drums that Al-Qaeda wants to get you. We have to send more troops to Afghanistan. Don't worry about Iraq. We also have to kill people with drones in Pakistan. And whatever place we want to play against another country next. WorldArchitectureNews.com has fortunately published an article by Richard Gage, as well as a couple of other folks from Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. It's called Conspiracy Theory or Hidden Truth, the 9/11 Enigmas. And that's a good move forward that an architecture site is covering the 9/11 Enigmas. Great piece on the dailymosin.com, M-O-H-S-I-N, I may be pronouncing that wrong, The Irrefutable Case for 9/11 Truth. This goes through the sort of fallacies and the logical fallacies of the arguments that people make against 9/11 truth. And we touched on that a little bit before. I don't have to put together an airtight situation to disprove the official story. Too many 9/11 commission questions still left unanswered. That's from Alan Rowland. Charlie Sheen's fantasy meeting with Obama over the 9/11 cover-up in a video of Sheen's message to Obama. This thing ended up generating a bunch of controversy within the so-called truther movement, and it looked like a PR stunt where essentially InfoWars was going to sell this as a real meeting that Charlie Sheen had with Obama. It's a fantasy meeting where he wrote this script as if he got to sit down with Obama for 20 minutes and talk about 9/11. They went about it in the wrong way, but I'm not here to attack other people and other radio hosts and other website guys, and when you guys start to do that, you're fucking it up. People can decide for themselves. People can discern information for themselves. I don't have to spend time attacking every little thing Alex Jones does that I don't like, or every other thing that whoever else does I don't like. I'm trying to be my own leader. What we try and do here is, again, give you the body of history, give you some of the tools, give you some of the keys, show you how I kind of did it, and you can do it too. And I ain't a genius, but all the information is there. So, I digress, but I don't have time for the infighting. And you shouldn't either. More from National Geographic. National Geo does 9/11, another icon debased in the service of a big lie. That's, again, from 9/11truth.org. And more on, again, the controversial 9/11 World Wildlife Fund ad, the 9/11 tsunami. I do have the video up for you. Let's do an experiment. I click it. Yes, it's still posted up. You can still get this minute-long ad. Last few updates again. Obama, as in his first 9/11 as president, honors victims' memory with a moment of silence. That's from the LA Times earlier this morning. Interesting one from the Associated Press. This headline caught my eye. This 9/11, Obama has the bullhorn on terrorism. Essentially telling you that now it's his turn to grandstand over the events therefore furthering the agenda. We had George Bush standing on the pile saying, I can hear you, and the people who knock down these buildings are going to hear all of us. So now it's Obama's turn, and it's Obama's war, and Iraq was a mistake, but now Afghanisurge is going to be Obama's war, barring, again, some other unrelated, seemingly catastrophic event. Obama has the bullhorn on terrorism. Again, following the same script, following the same playbook given by the blank check of 9/11. Wars, wiretapping, your grandma dumping out the water at the airport, people snitching on each other, cops doing God knows what, tasing us to death. I can't even think of all the things that still go on to this day. The last updated note here, coming from this morning from Raw Story. Informant says FBI threw away the chance to catch Atta, a Lebanon native who pretended to be an Islamic extremist at the behest of American authorities, claimed the FBI took him off the trail of alleged 9/11 plotter Mohammed Atta right as a window of opportunity opened to catch him. Were it not for the FBI's action, the informant says he is, quote, 1,000,000% positive, end quote, that 9/11 could have been prevented. The claims are part of an ABC News report that was sent to air last night on World News Tonight. The link is over there. I grabbed the video. I'm probably going to put it up on YouTube unless someone else has already done it. Informant says FBI threw away the chance to catch Atta. So much of this is like a bad dream in the boogeyman, not the boogeyman, but someone who is intimately connected to the events of 9/11, just not on the ground that day, but in the dealings before in New York City, and the mob connections, and the insurance scams, and the connections to Jerome Hauer and the Office of Emergency Management, and again, the drills going on the morning of 9/11. That facilitated these attacks and their success. Like a bad dream, Giuliani returns. He is now pushing a 9/11 re-education course for public schools.
For many New Yorkers, former Mayor Rudy Giuliani will forever be linked with the September 11th terror attack. He's now lending his support to a new school curriculum designed to teach students about the tragic day.
The idea of having an educational program like this for young people is very good. First of all, they can have to deal with it as part of history, no matter what. And secondly, they're dealing with it as part of their present.
But wherever Mayor Giuliani goes these days, he faces questions about his political future. He's been eyeing a run for governor and said on Sunday that he's still thinking about it. But on Tuesday, he wouldn't divulge much more.
Him on Meet the Press on Sunday. I haven't thought about it much since then.
The multimedia curriculum includes an interview with the former mayor, as well as one with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. But most New York City school children won't be among the first to try out the new teaching tool. Only three local schools have ordered the curriculum so far. In Lower Manhattan, Grace Rao, New York One.
I did grab that video and post it up to youtube.com/media monarchy, and they said in there, you know, everybody's asking about his political future. I don't want to know about that. I want to know about his parapolitical past. Links in there to read more about Hillary and Rudy, but we'll finish it with another quote from Giuliani that he says, quote, and secondly, they're dealing with it as a part of their present. Threats are still ongoing. The wars are still going on. More on Giuliani pushing this 9/11 re-education from truthnews.us. But we'll now hit another article from the UPI that connects and links to a big article from the New York Times. Trade Center wreckage finds new purpose in memorials. Steel debris from 9/11 on New York's World Trade Center is being offered to towns and cities for memorials. Nearly 2,000 pieces of steel, large and small, are being stored by the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, which has filled about 25 requests and has a dozen more pending. Twisted steel columns recently were shipped to York, Pennsylvania, and Westerville, Ohio, with a smaller piece shipped to the Air Defense offices in Rome, New York. That would be NEADS. That would be the Northeast Air Defense Sector, intimately involved with the drills and the lack of air response on the morning of 9/11. Requests must be approved by a federal judge overseeing wrongful death lawsuits stemming from the attack, noting the judge so far has granted all requests. What we want to check out right now is a flashback link to an article from Jerry Mazza from August 7th, 2006. Twin Tower wreckage turning up all over the place. And you thought all the 9/11 wreckage was swept up in 8 months and sent to be smelted in foreign countries or secret places in our own strange land, right? And that the rest of the rubble was buried in fresh kills, the appropriate name. So did I. So did everybody. So did people I mentioned this new article about. I thought they shipped it all off to China. But it now turns out... at last, remains of the towers were being stored in an 80,000-square-foot hangar at JFK International. The steel. And the questions about the collapse. I'm not going to get into those questions right here and right now, but they're there. They can give out all this steel for memorials, but can they give out more for scientists to check what went down when the towers went down? I should take the moment right here to mention that we're now into hour number two of the 140th episode of MediaMonarchy.com. It's September 11th, 2009, the 8th anniversary of the day that changed everything, they said. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show, MediaMonarchy.com, coming to you live from the Portland Radio Authority, PRARadio.org, as well as ZeroPointRadio.com, RevereRadio.net, FrOlympia.org, BoulderFreeRadio.com, BerkeleyLiberationRadio.net, and CascadiaPublicRadio.org. Now, I didn't mention at the top of the show, but again, perhaps for new folks out there, you can get in touch with me in any number of ways. FaceSpace, TwitterTube, Yahoo, Gmail, Skype, Instant Messenger, iTunes, RadioForAll.net, and Archive.org. I suggest you just subscribe to the main feed of MediaMonarchy.com. You get the episodes, you get the posts, you get everything. Now again, I want to reference my interview with Richard Grove of TragedyAndHope.com, where, thanks to my man Zach from right here in Portland, Oregon, I texted him a few days ago. I was like, hey, man, I'm going to interview Richard Grove. Anything I should mention? One, he said, geez, man, he's pretty much laid it all out in 9/11 synchronicity. Oh, but maybe ask him about Beverly Eckert. So I did. What you can hear in that interview is an exclusive recording made for Media Monarchy of Richard and Lisa Arbacheski, his partner in life and behind TragedyAndHope.com. She made a recording of a letter from the late Beverly Eckert called My Silence Cannot Be Bought. Quick backstory. We've covered Beverly Eckert. She was a 9/11 widow and activist. Her husband died on 9/11. She didn't take the payout money. She wanted to sue because she wanted to know how it all went so wrong. The air defenses, the collapses, everything. She was a 9/11 truther, and she wasn't shutting up. She met earlier this year with President Obama and some of the other 9/11 victims' family members who, again, to broach the entire subject of 9/11 truth, when folks say, you're just hurting people's feelings, you're hurting the families, most of the families are unhappy, to say the very least. They want a new investigation. They know, because it's documented, we've proved it, that the 9/11 Commission was, quote, set up to fail. They were being lied to and stonewalled by the feds and the agencies. It's all in their book, Without Precedent, the sort of precedent. Without precedent, rather. It's the sort of after-action report of the failed 9/11 Commission report. 7 days after meeting with Obama, Beverly Eckert died on the crash of Flight 3407. I interviewed writer and researcher Alex Constantine several months ago, and we went very in-depth into the mysterious, suspicious crash of Continental 3407. I recommend that interview as well to go down the rabbit hole of the connections and all the things that swirl around this. What I'm trying to say is, thanks to my man Zach for putting the idea of remembering Beverly Eckert. And again, you can hear that exclusive recording of the reading of Beverly's letter, My Silence Cannot Be Bought, within my interview with Richard Grove. So thanks to my man Zach for bringing up positive actions that resonate, as Rich would say. But let's make a quick note from the Associated Press. Sisters of Beverly Eckert, 9/11 activist widow, walk similar path. None of the Eckert sisters ever envisioned walking the halls of Congress, advocating to right wrongs to protect the country from tragedy. Not Beverly Eckert, a Stamford, Connecticut insurance executive before she lost her husband of 21 years on 9/11/01. Not Karen Eckert or Susan Bork, her sisters back home in Buffalo, New York, before Beverly's death in a plane crash earlier this year. Yet it's the path all would take, that of reluctant but determined advocate. First, Beverly, as one of the most visible faces pushing to fix problems exposed by the terrorist attacks that killed nearly 3,000 people. Now her sisters, taking on aviation safety following the February 12th crash of Beverly's plane, Continental Connection Flight 3407 near Buffalo, New York. She and 49 others died. I don't want anybody thinking, oh, there's this professional advocacy family stepping forward again, they're rabble-rousers, Karen Eckert said, describing her initial reluctance, or have people think we're using Beverly. Yet after Beverly's death, they found themselves, like she had, in a position to be effective advocates, unburdened at home by the demands of young children and with enough knowledge and passion to drive them through their grief toward action.
Became the face of two tragedies is being honored for her work to make the world a safer place. Next Friday, the group Voices of September the 11th will present its annual Building Bridges Award posthumously to Beverly Eckert. Beverly's husband, Sean, was killed on 9/11, and she co-founded the group. She was heading back here to her hometown to award a scholarship in her husband's name when she died in the crash of Flight 3407.
The story of 3407 is very deep, and I can't really get into it right here. But in the interview with Alex Constantine and with the new interview with Richard Grove, we do go into some of the connections surrounding this. And the law firm that we just referenced that she worked for is called Skadden Arps, which you heard in that quick clip I played at the top of the show. You can also hit the flashback link to my original posting of this story back in February of this year, 9/11 widow and activist among 50 killed in New York plane crash. And again, through all this, I don't want to be callous about the gravity of everything that we're dealing with. I don't want to do it glibly or coldly. We want to do this because a lot of people have died, not just on 9/11. But again, as you look at the body of history pre-9/11, it's essentially a war on consciousness, but sometimes blood is shed as well. I don't want to be glib and I don't want to be callous, but I want to be forceful and firm and keep pushing this. It's important. You know it's important. So, my deepest respect and sympathy and heart go out to all of those affected physically and mentally and emotionally and financially by 9/11. One last note here from current 9/11 news, and all of this sort of sets the table for what we're going to get into. Sunday, September 6, 2009, from the San Francisco Guardian, John Ashcroft can be sued over jailing witnesses. Former Attorney General John Ashcroft can be sued for damages for ordering Muslims jailed as material witnesses in criminal cases, allegedly as a pretext to investigate their possible links to terrorism, a federal appeals court in San Francisco ruled last Friday the 4th. The 2-1 decision by the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, the first of its kind in the nation, was a rebuke to the Bush administration's post-9/11 practice of using the material witness law to hold people as suspected terrorists without evidence that they had committed crimes. The government lacks the power to arrest and detain or restrict American citizens for months on end merely because the government wishes to investigate them for possible wrongdoing. That's a quote from Judge Milan Smith, an appointee of former President George W. Bush. She said that, previous quote, in the majority opinion. Furthermore, quote, "We find this to be repugnant to the Constitution and a painful reminder of some of the most ignominious chapters of our national history." And we'll have to unfortunately note that new chapters are being written. Because the same thing continues to this day. Obama is continuing the practice of what I believe is called indefinite detentions. Let's hit the Google. Let's run a Google. Washington Post. Obama endorses indefinite detention without trial for some now at Guantanamo. This is May 22nd of this year. President Obama acknowledged publicly for the first time that some detainees at Gitmo may have to be held without trial indefinitely, siding with conservative national security advocates on one of the most contentious issues raised by the closing of the military prison in Cuba. Does this relate exactly? Is this the same thing as jailing Muslims as it is jailing those terrorists in Guantanamo? It is, because ultimately they're people, and ultimately they're people that were scooped up for one reason or another. And if you don't speak out because you're not a Muslim, and if you don't speak out because you're not a Jew, or you didn't speak out because you weren't a religious person, you didn't speak out because you weren't an activist or an organizer, you're going to find that when they come for you, there will be no one left to speak out for you. And it's with all that that we're now going to get into the heart of this episode, the heart of this anniversary episode, where again, I note that it's also the 4th anniversary of MediaMonarchy.com. You can track back to the first post, September 11th, 2005. I believe it's called Electronic Behavior Control System. But we're here right now, September 11th, 2009, the 140th episode of Media Monarchy, the radio show, which has been running now for almost 3 years. I put something together using two amazing resources. And I posted this up, and it's essentially a link and a video. A link and a video. 11 points of contention with the official story of 9/11. Using the amazing resources of HistoryCommons.org and their complete 9/11 timeline, and CoreOfCorruption.com and their complete news archive that's available on YouTube as a playlist, 153 videos that, again, we went over at the very end of the B-side of the previous episode, contains an amazing amount of mainstream news sources on this video archive relating to drug running, bank scandals, anthrax, Watergate, shadow government, the Trilateral Commission, the Bohemian Grove, all these things that are essentially suppressed news. They do get mentions. Most of the clips are very short. But what makes up the bulk of Core of Corruption's complete news archive is a lot of the stories relating to the official story of 9/11. So using the amazing resources of History Commons and Core of Corruption, let's look at some of the key elements surrounding the events of the day that changed everything. This is by no means an exhaustive list, but it should give us a general survey of some of the contradictions contained within the official story. Point one. Now, the way that this rolls, we have a date, we have a link, and we have a video. July 26, 2001. Attorney General John Ashcroft stops flying commercial airlines and refuses to explain why.
There are unanswered questions and secrecy tonight on another government matter. The core question in this case, why is the Attorney General of the United States doing all his air travel by specially chartered jet at taxpayer expense? CBS's Jim Stewart has been looking into this for you.
Fishing rod in hand, Attorney General John Ashcroft left on a weekend trip to Missouri this afternoon aboard a chartered government jet in response to inquiries from CBS News over why Ashcroft was traveling exclusively by leased jet aircraft instead of commercial airlines. The Justice Department cited what it called a threat assessment by the FBI and said Ashcroft has been advised to travel only by private jet for the remainder of his term. There was a threat assessment and there are guidelines. He is acting under the guidelines, an FBI spokesman said. Neither the FBI nor the Justice Department, however, would identify what the threat was, when it was detected, or who made it. A senior official at the CIA said he was unaware of any specific threats against any cabinet member, and Ashcroft himself at a speech in California seemed unsure of the threat.
What can you tell us about the nature of that threat?
I don't do threat assessments myself, and I rely on those whose responsibility it is to in the law enforcement community, particularly the FBI.
Do you know anything about it or who might have made it?
I think it's... Frankly, I don't.
Earlier this week, the Justice Department leased this NASA-owned G3 Gulfstream for a six-day trip to western states. Such aircraft cost the government more than $1,600 an hour to fly. When asked whether Ashcroft was paying for any portion of the trips devoted to personal business, a Justice Department spokeswoman declined to respond. All other Bush cabinet appointees, with the exception of Interior and Energy with remote sites overseas, fly commercial. The Secretaries of State and Defense traditionally travel with extra security on military aircraft.
Former Attorney General Janet Reno routinely flew commercial, and the Justice Department insisted that it wasn't Ashcroft who wanted to fly leased aircraft. That plan, they said, was strictly the idea of Ashcroft's FBI security detail. The FBI had no further comment. Dan.
July 26, 2001. CBS News reports that Attorney General Ashcroft has stopped flying commercial airlines due to a threat assessment, but neither the FBI nor the Justice Department would identify to CBS what the threat was, when it was detected, or who made it. One newspaper reports Ashcroft demonstrated an amazing lack of curiosity when asked if he knew anything about the threat. "Frankly, I don't," he told reporters. It is later reported that he stopped flying in July based on threat assessments made on May 8th and June 19th. In May 2002, it's claimed the threat assessment had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda, but Ashcroft walked out of his office rather than answer questions about it. The San Francisco Chronicle will later conclude, "The FBI obviously knew something was in the wind. The FBI did advise Ashcroft to stay off commercial aircraft. The rest of us just had to take our chances." CBS's Dan Rather will later ask of this warning, "Why wasn't it shared with the public at large?" On July 5th, the CIA had warned Ashcroft to expect multiple imminent Al-Qaeda attacks overseas, and on July 12th, the FBI warned him that the Al-Qaeda threat within the U.S. Sources within that to, of course, CBS News, and that July 26, 2001 broadcast we just heard, but also to the San Francisco Chronicle, the Associated Press, and the Washington Post. The second point of contention with the official story of 9/11, September 20th, 2001, reports on suspicious trading of companies affected by 9/11.
Federal officials have begun a major investigation into whether someone or many people benefited financially from the evil done to the country last Tuesday. Not long before the attacks occurred, there were some financial transactions in the stock market that may indicate knowledge of the attack before it began. ABC's Antonio Mora is here. Whether they ever get to, if they ever get to the bottom of it, it will be astonishing.
Astonishing, no question, Peter. What many Wall Street analysts believe is that the terrorists made bets that a number of stocks would see their prices fall. They did so by buying what are called puts. If you bet right, the reward can be huge. The risks are also huge, unless, of course, you know something bad is going to happen to the company you're betting against.
This could very well be insider trading at the worst, most horrific, most evil use you've ever seen in your entire life.
One example, United Airlines. The Thursday before the attack, more than 2,000 contracts betting that the stock would go down were purchased, 90 times more in one day than in 3 weeks. When the markets reopened, United's stock dropped. The price of the contracts soared, and someone may have made a lot of money fast.
$180,000 turns into $2.4 million when that plane hits the World Trade Center.
It's almost the same story with American Airlines.
That's a five-fold increase in the value of what was a $337,000 trade on Monday.
All of a sudden becomes what?
$1.8 million.
And there's much more, including an extraordinarily high number of bets against Morgan Stanley and Marcin McLennan, two of the World Trade Center's biggest tenants.
Could this be a coincidence? This would be one of the most extraordinary coincidences in the history of mankind if it was a coincidence.
It is absolutely unprecedented to see cases of insider trading covering the entire world, from Japan to the United States and North America to Europe.
ABC News has now learned that the Chicago Board of Options Exchange launched their investigation into the unusual trading last week. That may have given them enough time to stop anyone from profiting from death here in the U.S. It may also give investigators, Peter, a hot trail that might lead them to the terrorists.
Thanks very much. As a reminder of complex complications here, though, the Secretary of the Treasury said today of this investigation, you've got to go through 10 veils before you get to the real source.
Yep.
Thanks, Antonio.
Insider trading based on advanced knowledge of the 9/11 attacks may have begun by at least August 6th, 2001, if not earlier. Investigators later discover a large number of put option purchases, a speculation that the stock will go down, that expire on September 30th at the Chicago Board Options Exchange that are bought on August 6th. If exercised, these options would have led to large profits, one analyst later says. From what I'm hearing, it's more than a coincidence. Source, Reuters. The Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, later announces that they investigate the trading of shares of 38 companies in the days just before 9/11. The San Francisco Chronicle reports that the New York Stock Exchange sees, quote, unusually heavy trading in airline and related stocks several days before the attacks. All 38 companies logically stand to be heavily affected by the attacks. They include parent companies of major airlines, American, Continental, Delta, Northwest, Southwest, United, and U.S. Airways, as well as the cruise lines Carnival and Royal Caribbean, aircraft maker Boeing, and defense contractor Lockheed Martin. The SEC is also looking into suspicious short selling of numerous insurance company stock, but to date, no details of this investigation have been released. More sources from the Associated Press and the San Francisco Chronicle. The Chicago Board Options Exchange sees suspicious trading on Merrill Lynch and Morgan Stanley, two of the largest WTC tenants. In the first week of September, an average of 27 put option contracts in its shares are bought each day. Then the total for the 3 days before the attacks is over 2,000. Sources, The Independent and ABC News. $2.5 million in put options on American Airlines and United Airlines are reported unclaimed. On September 29, 2001, this is likely the result of the suspension in trading on the New York Stock Exchange after the attacks, which gave the SEC time to be waiting if the owners showed up to redeem their put options placed the week before the attacks. Source, San Francisco Chronicle. September 10, 2003, Slate reports that 2 years after 9/11, neither the Chicago Board Options Exchange nor the Securities and Exchange Commission will make any comment about their investigations into insider trading before 9/11. Quote, neither has announced any conclusion. The SEC has not filed any complaint alleging illegal activity, nor has the Justice Department announced any investigation or prosecution. So unless the SEC decides to file a complaint, unlikely at this late stage, we may never know what they learned about terror trading. A related note, early September 2001, German Central Bank President Ernst Weltkeke, W-E-L-T-E-K-E, Later reports that a study by his bank indicates, quote, there are even clearer signs that there were activities on international financial markets that must have been carried out with the necessary expert knowledge. Not only in shares of heavily affected industries such as airlines and insurance companies, but also in gold and oil. His researchers have found, quote, almost irrefutable proof of insider trading. Sources to the Daily Telegraph, the Miami Herald, Fox News, and again the Daily Telegraph. Point of contention with the official story of 9/11, number 3. May 17, 2002, multiple reports of multiple terror threats before 9/11.
Questions persisted today about what President Bush knew and what he should have known about terror threats before September 11. Administration officials say no one could have imagined the kind of attacks that we saw that day, but it turns out someone did. A federal report 2 years earlier warned that terrorists could crash an aircraft packed with explosives into a government building. The president insisted today there was no indication such an attack was coming. Bob Schieffer is at the White House for us tonight. Bob?
Well, John, the president's first public comment came in a welcome here for the Air Force Academy football team, and he was clearly vexed.
You know what's interesting about Washington? It's a town, unfortunately, it's the kind of place where second-guessing has become second nature.
He said bluntly there was no advance warning of the 9/11 attack.
The American people know this about me and my national security team and my administration. Had I known that the enemy was going to use airplanes to kill on that fateful morning, I would have done everything in my power to protect the American people.
Other top officials were less forthcoming. The usually talkative Attorney General just stared when reporters asked him, the FBI chief. The White House confirms intelligence agencies had reported in August that Osama bin Laden might resort to aircraft hijackings, but no one thought planes would be used as they were. Perhaps as a key senator, because the intelligence agencies weren't talking to each other.
They didn't share information to speak of. The one agency didn't know what the other was doing.
A psychological profile of al-Qaeda terrorists given to the CIA in 1999 by the Library of Congress concluded one option terrorists might try was to crash land an aircraft packed with high explosives into the Pentagon, the CIA, or the White House. It apparently got little notice, and the White House dismissed it today as speculative. The situation has set off a nasty partisan political fight. Last night, the vice president lit into Democrats who raised questions about who knew what.
Such commentary is thoroughly irresponsible and totally unworthy of national leaders in a time of war.
Democrats, of course, took exception.
I'm very disappointed in what he has to say. American people expect and deserve answers as to what happened on September 11th. This isn't about assigning blame or pointing fingers. It's about preventing it from ever happening again.
Congressional leaders say that the White House has resisted an investigation into the intelligence failures, but with all this commotion, the White House said tonight it is willing to cooperate with an investigation if it's done right. John.
Bob Schieffer at a rainy White House for us tonight. Thanks. In the months before September 11th, the government alerted the nation's airlines many times about terror threats. The public at large was kept in the dark. Bob Orr, who covers aviation for CBS News, tells you tonight what the airlines were told.
15 times between January and September last year, the FAA issued terrorism alerts to U.S. airlines. But sources say not once prior to September 11th did federal regulators order security tightened at U.S. airports.
Authorities say the intelligence which prompted the alerts was too general in nature to dictate a specific security response. But in hindsight, the warning contained some chilling details.
Twice last April, the FAA alerted airlines to the continuing possibility of violence against U.S. citizens and urged carriers to practice a high degree of awareness. June brought a more specific bulletin. The FAA warned of possible hijackings, saying American interests may be targeted by extremist groups. In July, only 2 months before the attack, the FAA went even further, alerting airlines that terror groups are known to be planning and training for hijackings. But the Bush administration said the warnings were too vague to share with the traveling public.
You would have risked shutting down the American civil aviation system with such generalized information. I think you would have had to think 5, 6, 7 times about that very, very hard.
And the White House says no one last summer feared that a simple hijacking could turn into a suicide attack.
The fact that there are terrorists who seek to hijack airlines in the pre-911 traditional sense is not new.
There were still other alerts. Twice, airlines were warned of a plot to bomb the baggage claim area of Los Angeles International Airport. Another July bulletin described a particular weapon system, which might be used as a threat to civil aviation. Then in August, airlines were warned terrorists had new techniques to disguise firearms as cell phones, keychains, and pens. Despite all of these alerts, the government and the airlines insist there was never enough solid information to mandate more security, and nothing that truly warned of the horror to follow. Bob Orr, CBS News, Washington.
That's a CBS News report from May 17, 2002, and we'll hit an auxiliary report from September 1999. U.S. report predicts spectacular attack on Washington. A report prepared for U.S. intelligence titled "The Sociology and Psychology of Terrorism" is completed. It states, quote, "Al-Qaeda's expected retaliation for the U.S. cruise missile attack could take several forms of terrorist attack in the nation's capital. Al-Qaeda could detonate a Chechen-type building buster bomb at a federal building. Suicide bombers belonging to Al-Qaeda's Martyrdom Battalion could crash land an aircraft packed with high explosives, C4 and Simtex, into the Pentagon, the headquarters of the CIA, or the White House. Whatever form an attack may take, bin Laden will most likely retaliate in a spectacular way." The report is by the National Intelligence Council, which advises the President and U.S. Intel on emerging threats. Source, Associated Press. The Bush administration later claims to have never heard of this report until May 2002, and despite the fact that it had been publicly posted on the Internet since 1999 and widely shared within the government, according to the New York Times, as well as CNN. Point of contention number 4, June 2, 2002, multiple reports of the intelligence failures surrounding two of the alleged hijackers, Al-Hazmi and Al-Midar.
A closer look now at criticism of the U.S. intelligence community. In the current issue of Newsweek magazine, writer Michael Isikoff reports that the CIA was actively tracking two of the suspected September 11th hijackers and even trailed those men pictured here to an Al-Qaeda summit in Malaysia. Here's what he told CNN.
The CIA knew who they were. They knew that they were suspected Al-Qaeda operatives, and they failed to alert the INS, the State Department, the Customs Service, agencies that could have kept them out of the country, and perhaps more importantly, they failed to alert the FBI, which could have tracked them while they were in the country. What's stunning is that from that moment on, they lived entirely out in the open. They opened up bank accounts, they got a California driver's license, they opened up credit cards, and they intersected with at least five other of the hijackers on September 11th. This is probably the biggest intelligence failure surrounding the events of September 11th of all. And in some way, in many ways, it dwarfs the disclosures that have come out about the FBI and its failure to act on warnings from its field offices in Phoenix and in Minneapolis, because this does involve two of the hijackers.
Earlier today, the White House issued a statement asking Americans not to rush to judgment based on that single report. Meanwhile, former CIA Director James Woolsey will join me tonight at 10 o'clock Eastern Time with reaction to the Newsweek report. Please don't miss that. That's at 10 o'clock Eastern Time right here on CNN. Amid plans to overhaul his agency, FBI Director Robert Mueller says that he welcomes the criticism from Agent Colleen Rowley, a whistleblower based in the FBI office in Minneapolis. Today, he spoke about a letter that he received from Rowley, adding that he welcomes the input, but he doesn't agree with all the points.
What we were focused on is protecting the American public. That is what we were focused on at that point. And I think it is important to go back and look at what happened prior to September 11th. It's important to do that in order to make certain that we don't repeat those mistakes.
After being alerted by the CIA that top Al-Qaeda leaders plan to meet in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, the local security service, Malaysia's security branch, monitors the operatives there. The surveillance begins with the arrival of Khalid Al-Midar from Dubai on January 5th when he is met at the airport by a militant named Hikmat Shakir Ahmad. A video recording is made, photographs are taken, and when attendees visit an internet cafe, the hard drives of the computers they used are searched. All this info is passed to the CIA. However, it will later be reported that despite the heavy surveillance, no audio recordings are made of what the attendees actually talk about. Further documentation of the tracking of two of the alleged hijackers and the connections to informants, as well as CIA infiltration of these groups, comes from HistoryCommons.org, as well as U.S. Congress, the 9/11 Commission, the Ottawa Citizen, the Observer, the New Yorker, CNN, Newsweek, Stern, CBC, and the Associated Press. Point of contention number five, reports of infighting and CIA infiltration of al-Qaeda from this June 4th, 2002 report from NBC.
Good evening. As the war against terrorism goes on, including the so far unsuccessful hunt for Osama bin Laden, the war in Washington is between the CIA and the FBI. It's now painfully clear they had a lot of signals something big was up, and they failed to coordinate their efforts to track down suspects and intercept plans. Today it was disclosed the CIA even had plans within al-Qaeda. All of this was the subject of presidential comment and a closed-door hearing on Capitol Hill. We'll begin with NBC's Andrea Mitchell.
The president today at the super-secret National Security Agency, America's electronic eavesdroppers, and one of the agencies that missed signals about Osama bin Laden's plot until it was too late.
As I said, I had seen no evidence that would have led me to believe that we could have prevented the attack.
But shouldn't they have known? For the first time today, officials confirmed the CIA did have agents inside bin Laden's operation before September 11th. In fact, CIA Director George Tenet only hinted at when questioned last February.
What fellows at the Dodge City Coffee Clutch asked me is, if John Walker Lane could get to talk to Osama bin Laden, why in the heck couldn't the CIA get an agent closer to him?
Well, I'm not going to do this in open session, but you better tell everybody at the cafe it's not true.
The intelligence agencies also had electronic intercepts. The NSA monitors 2 million communications every hour, telephone calls, faxes, emails, including, we now know, critical clues about the hijackers, like their meeting in Malaysia.
It was actionable information. And what's clear to me as a former intelligence officer is that somebody in Washington dropped the ball. Whether it was an FBI or CIA is to be determined.
But with so much information pouring in, the government had only 5 translators for the languages spoken in Afghanistan.
And that's one of the reasons why they missed a lot of this material, is because it stores up, and it may be 6 months before they actually get somebody to analyze it.
Even if they had enough translators, there's no guarantee they would put the 9/11 clues together. And another reason they fail, bin Laden and his men don't talk outside a tight circle. Here, bin Laden brags that some of the hijackers didn't know the plan until the last minute. He says, quote, "We did not reveal the operation to them until they are there and just before they boarded the plane."
So is the problem now being fixed? The CIA is hiring translators, but it can take as long as a year to get security clearances, while millions more communications pile up unread. Andrea Mitchell, NBC News, Washington.
And on Capitol Hill today, more of the same. The House and Senate Intelligence Committees went into secret session as they tried to determine why no one headed off 911. As NBC's Lisa Myers reports, in the early stages at least, the blame game is getting most of the attention.
Up a back stairwell to the fourth floor of the Capitol, behind closed doors, Congressional Intelligence Committee's meeting in a special soundproof room today began sifting through the debris of 9/11. Sources say some 200 interviews and 100,000 pages of documents reviewed so far reveal even more dropped balls by both the CIA and FBI than is now publicly known.
We will be looking at every instance of the intelligence community where there were opportunities, or seemingly opportunities, that nothing was acted upon.
The most critical dropped ball, investigators say, is that the CIA identified two of the hijackers as terrorists a year and a half before the attacks, Khalid al-Mihdhar and Nawaf al-Hamzi, knew they were headed to this country and did almost nothing until it was too late. Sources tell NBC News the FBI has developed a series of charts for congressional investigators to show that had there been follow-up, al-Hamzi and al-Mihdhar would have led them directly to 5 other hijackers, and by connecting the dots to everyone else, including ringleader Mohammed Atta. charts infuriate the CIA. Today, the Senate top Democrat called on both agencies to stop the sniping.
I think the infighting is deplorable.
The FBI has its own drop ball to explain. A top FBI counterterrorism official told Congress today that he never saw the Phoenix memo warning of Arab men in flight schools until after 9/11, even though it was addressed to him. Despite all the lapses, former Senator Warren Rudman, an intelligence expert, says Congress should tone down the criticism.
I'm deeply concerned when I see members of Congress publicly attacking these agencies. These are our first line of defense, as imperfect as they are.
Later this week, investigators will question a former CIA counterintelligence chief on what he knew. Sources predict that when the investigation concludes, it will show plenty of leads to the terrorists, but probably no clear signals on exactly what they were up to. Lisa Myers, NBC News, the Capitol.
NBC News, June 4th, 2002. Further context from HistoryCommons.org and the shouting match and the infighting between the CIA and the FBI. Point of contention number 6 with the official story of 9/11, June 2002, reports on NSA intercepts of Tomorrow is Zero Hour and Watch the News.
Just one item tonight about the September attacks. ABC News' Pierre Thomas confirmed late today that the National Security Agency intercepted at least one phone conversation before the September attacks in which it was mentioned that something big was going to happen on the 11th. This is the first U.S. intelligence we have heard that refers to a specific date for the attack. The conversation was in Arabic and was not translated until after the 11th.
With an FBI whistleblower's warnings about a bloated and ineffective bureaucracy knocked off the front pages, signs of any substantial follow-up in Washington are few. But congressional investigators in both parties said privately there is some in progress and that it will be back in the news in the weeks ahead. On that score, CBS's Bob Schieffer quotes key sources tonight as saying the National Security Agency picked up information on September 10th that something big was coming. But the information, these sources say, was not translated until the day after the attack on America. Only then did the NSA realize the significance of its information.
That was a CBS News report from June 11, 2002, preceded by a June 7, 2002 report from ABC News. The context, September 10, 2001, NSA intercepts The Match Begins Tomorrow, and Tomorrow is Zero Hour. Further documentation from Reuters, ABC News, and on and on. The other bit, Watch the News, and Tomorrow will be a great day for us. More on the NSA intercepts from September 10th, 2001. Documentation from USA Today and ABC News. Point of contention number 7 with the official story of 9/11, October 17th, 2002. George Tenet misinforms congressional inquiry about CIA knowledge of the hijackers' entry into the U.S.
On Capitol Hill today, a hearing about U.S. intelligence failures before 9/11 featured a sobering prediction from someone in a position to know. George Tenet, CBS's Bob Schieffer has our report.
The hearings couldn't have ended on a more ominous note as the CIA chief leveled a grim warning.
Because the threat environment we find ourselves in today is as bad as it was last summer, the summer before 9/11. It is serious. They have reconstituted. They're coming after us. They want to execute attacks. You see it in Bali. You see it in Kuwait. They plan in multiple theaters of operation. They intend to strike this homeland again.
The sobering assessment came as newly declassified government documents provided more detail on the 9/11 terrorist plot. Among the disclosures, the CIA believes the 1999 crash of an Egyptian airliner by a suicide-bent pilot convinced Al-Qaeda the vulnerability of commercial airliners. Underlings wanted to use small aircraft loaded with dynamite to ram the Twin Towers, but it was Osama bin Laden himself who suggested using bigger planes. The hijackers were not all the religious zealots once thought. Some who were recruited had problems with depression and alcohol and were drifters in search of purpose. The disclosures did not blunt congressional criticism of bureaucratic fumbling of key information before the attack or disbelief that no one had yet been held accountable.
I have not held somebody accountable in the sense of either disciplining or firing somebody. This is not
a matter of scapegoating. This is a matter of accountability. There's been, I believe, too little effort made to pinpoint the responsibility.
With these hearings ending, those answers won't be coming soon. Many here in Congress now want a national commission to be formed to make a more thorough investigation, but can't reach agreement with the White House on how to form such a commission, so that may not happen either. Dan?
Bob Schieffer reporting live from Capitol Hill.
October 17, 2002, Tenet misinforms congressional inquiry about CIA knowledge of hijackers' entry into the U.S. In sworn testimony to the 9/11 congressional inquiry, CIA Director George Tenet repeatedly claims that a March 2000 cable sent to CIA headquarters reporting that hijacker Nawaf al-Hazmi had entered the U.S. wasn't read by anybody. He says, quote, "I know that nobody read that cable," quote, "nobody read that cable in the March time frame," and quote, "nobody read that information only cable." Former Counterterrorism Center Director Kofor Black will also claim that the cable was not read. However, a later investigation by the CIA Office of Inspector General will find that numerous officers had actually read the cable shortly after it was sent. Nevertheless, the 9/11 Commission will later assert that, quote, "no one outside the Counterterrorist Center was told any of this." And they neglect to mention that Tenet had previously misstated the CIA's knowledge of the hijackers. Neither will the 9/11 Commission investigate the cause of the CIA's apparent inaction. Sources to the 9/11 Commission and the New York Times. Point of contention, number 8. On the list of 11 points of contention with the official story of 9/11, December 6, 2002, U.S. investigators pressed to look into P-TECH.
Turning to the war on terror, federal agents raided a Massachusetts computer software firm overnight, and they insisted that an initial read today showed no threat to national security. But CBS Boston station WBZ-TV and CBS News have been digging into this same company for months. Jim Axelrod has what our own independent investigation found.
Hours after the president and CEO walked out, the federal agents went in, raiding this nondescript building in suburban Boston, looking for evidence that could tie the computer consulting for P-TECH to international terrorism. P-TECH's CEO is Osama Ziadi. This is him, 3 years ago in Saudi Arabia. He's pictured with a man named Yassin al-Qadi, a Saudi named by President Bush as a financial backer of Osama bin Laden.
Yassin al-Qadi fits in this category of wealthy Saudi businessmen who believe in and finance radical Islamic extremist groups worldwide.
In an investigation done by CBS station WBZ-TV, three sources say al-Qadi is the chief financial backer of P-TECH. Then there's P-TECH board member Yaqub Mirza. He's an officer for a string of Islamic charities which have been a concern to the U.S. government. This becomes all the more alarming when you learn exactly what it is P-TECH does. The company works in enterprise architecture, the blueprinting of an entire computer network. Computer consultant Indira Singh says such a company could gain full access to a client's data.
That could be rather dangerous.
It could be devastatingly dangerous.
Especially when you examine the roster of P-TECH's clients. The company's webpage lists the FBI, the IRS, NATO, the Air Force, the Naval Air Command, the Departments of Energy and Education, the Postal Service, the U.S. House of Representatives. Other sources say P-TECH has done business with the Department of Defense, the Secret Service, even the White House.
And that gives you a tremendous opportunity, if you're so inclined, to examine, manipulate, download all of the most sensitive information of whoever it is you've contracted with.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But tonight, the National Security Agency tells CBS News it is absolutely convinced P-TECH software is safe.
I'm sure that in the end they can find that there's nothing of interest here.
But experts like Matthew Levitt look at Yassin al-Qadi and disagree.
For someone like that to be involved in any capacity in an organization, a company that has access to classified information, that has access to government open or classified computer systems, would be of grave concern.
Federal agents may soon know if P-TECH is just a company with some questionable connections or a true threat to the nation's security. Jim Axelrod, CBS News, New York.
CBS News, December 6, 2002, and in addition to the related History Commons entry, U.S. investigators pressed to look into P-TECH, which contains documented links to Boston Globe, NPR, WBZ4 in Boston, Newsweek, and the Associated Press. I'd also like to point listeners to my recent interview with James Corbett of Corbett Report, where we extensively covered the P-TECH story and 9/11 and cyber terrorism. The ninth point of contention with the official story, July 29, 2004, FBI letter vindicates many of whistleblower Sibel Edmonds' allegations.
Back in the country, a newly disclosed letter confirms charges by a former FBI interpreter that she was, in fact, fired, at least in part, because she blew the whistle on total incompetent workers at the FBI. CBS's Jim Stewart has been digging into this.
When the FBI fired interpreter Sibel Edmonds more than 2 years ago after only a few months on the job, it had no idea the can of worms it was opening up, and today it got yet another taste. In a letter released on Capitol Hill, FBI Director Robert Mueller acknowledged that a recently concluded Internal Justice Department investigation found a contributing factor in Edmonds' firing was the fact that she had accused the Bureau of ineptitude. Ineptitude, Edmonds insisted today, that still exists.
The problems were systemic problems that existed within the FBI's translation unit that involved security breaches and also incompetence. These were the problems I reported.
Edmonds is now working on her PhD and acts as an advisor to the 9/11 families. It was just after the 9/11 attacks that she offered her services to the FBI as a Turkish and Middle Eastern language specialist. But shortly after joining the Bureau's Washington field office, she said she encountered sloppy work by colleagues and was told by superiors to work slower so the Bureau might justify demands for a bigger budget.
I was warned that if I were to make these issues public and take it outside the Bureau, I would be retaliated against and I would be fired. And exactly that's what occurred.
Mueller said he would work with the Justice Department to determine whether disciplinary action is required of any Bureau employees as a result of the Edmonds case.
Meanwhile, the FBI insists it's make progress with its translation problems by hiring more interpreters. On 9/11, it had only 70 Arabic speakers. Today, it has more than 200, but admits it needs more. Jim Stewart, CBS News at the FBI.
Now, we must note, in addition to the related History Commons entry, July 29, 2004, FBI letter vindicates many of whistleblower Sibel Edmonds' allegations. Recently, source to bradblog.com, Sibel Edmonds recently gave a multiple-hour deposition documenting many of her claims that previously she had been prevented because she was under a gag order. The 10th point of contention out of 11 on the official story of 9/11, February 10, 2005, even more reports of FAA warnings, briefs, memos, and threats.
But it has been, as you know, several months now since the 9/11 Commission investigating the attacks on the country kept the nation enthralled with its public proceedings and its report. We thought we had had it all. Today we learned there is more, namely the information that the Federal Aviation Administration received 52 warnings about Al-Qaeda in the 6 months before 9/11 and did not, apparently, heed them. Here's ABC's Pierre Thomas.
A classified portion of the 9/11 Commission report is highly critical of the Federal Aviation Administration for taking no meaningful action after the repeated warnings.
Anyone who reads our report and this staff paper, it should take blood pressure medicine first, because there was a lot of negligence.
According to the report, just months before the attacks, the FAA's own intelligence officials warned airlines and airports about the possibility that terrorists might conduct suicide hijackings. A series of secret FAA memos were entitled Osama bin Laden, World Islamic Front Hijacking Threat. In July 2001, FAA intelligence officials concluded members of foreign terrorist groups are present in the United States and pose an increasing threat to civil aviation.
What is striking, said commissioners, is that even with all this information, the government, airport, and airline officials chose to do nothing.
One can't understand this almost willful effort to ignore the warning signs that were there.
Family members of the 9/11 victims say they're outraged.
Personally, it makes me feel that my husband's life could have been saved.
Despite all the information, the FAA said today it had received no specific information before 9/11 that called for specific countermeasures. Aviation sources tell ABC News that at the time, they and Congress were more concerned about airline delays than airline security.
What the FAA could have done was to instruct, to order the airlines and the Air Force to increase increase security. There are a number of specific steps that one does on a heightened security. They didn't do that.
Sources close to the 9/11 Commission say there are still more revelations about pre-9/11 intelligence yet to come. Pierre Thomas, ABC News, Washington.
ABC News, February 10th, 2005, and the four related links from HistoryCommons.org. January through August 2001, airlines receive FAA warnings, but later claim they were given no real hints of possible terrorist attacks. Sources to CNN, the Miami Herald, St. Petersburg Times, the Associated Press, and the New York Observer. March through May 01, FAA briefs airports on security. They cite, then dismiss, the possibility of planes as weapons. Source to the New York Times, Newsday, the New Jersey Star, Ledger. FBI sends memo warning that unusual number of Muslim extremists are learning to fly in Arizona. This is July 10th, 2001. This came from FBI agent Ken Williams, and it is known as the Phoenix Memo. Lastly, July 31st, 2001, FAA issues hijacking warning, no specific domestic threat. Links to the 9/11 Commission and CNN and Ananova. The 11th point of contention with the official story of 9/11 comes from September 14th, 2005, reports on Able Danger evidence and secret sessions.
Well, the Pentagon reportedly does not want the public to hear next week's Senate testimony about the former secret intelligence unit known as Able Danger. Two congressional sources have told Fox News that the military is pressuring senators to move the hearings behind closed doors. But we're told the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator Arlen Specter, wants to keep the hearings open. People who claim they used to work with the Able Danger unit say that unit identified as threats for the September 11th hijackers a full year before the attacks.
September 14th, 2005, former 9/11 Commission members dismiss Able Danger evidence, with links and sources to the Associated Press, the aforementioned Fox News, as well as Newsweek. Oh, hell, let's just throw in one more note. Out of the literally thousands of points of contention with the official story of 9/11, and if you hit the complete 9/11 timeline from HistoryCommons.org, you will see that they currently, as of this moment, have 6,118 events linked contextually on the complete 9/11 timeline. So let's just make it an even dozen and throw in one more point, and we'll jump back to Halloween 2002, reports on the World Trade Center gold that was transported, allegedly almost stolen, and then recovered.
And at Ground Zero tonight, found after 7 weeks, buried under the wreckage, $200 million in gold and silver in a vault that belonged to the Bank of Nova Scotia below 5 World Trade Center, which was adjacent to the Twin Towers. Armored cars were brought into the site, taking treasure away under the watchful eye of extra police and National Guard troops. Some construction workers who offered to help load the truck were politely told, "No thanks, we can do this ourselves."
October 31st, 2002, NBC News report. As we link to three related entries on the 9/11 timeline, September 11, 2001, before 9:59 a.m., gold transported through WTC basement. Large amounts of gold are stored in the vaults in the massive basement below the WTC, and some of this is being transported through the basement on the morning of 9/11. Several weeks later, recovery workers will discover hundreds of ingots in a service tunnel below World Trade Center 5, along with a 10-wheel lorry and some cars which were presumably transporting the gold. The lorry and cars had been crushed by falling steel, but no bodies will be reportedly found with them, so presumably they were abandoned before the first building collapsed. The second entry, mid-October to mid-November 2001, gold and silver recovered from WTC basement area. Evidence suggests attempted theft. Workers at Ground Zero discover large amounts of gold and other precious metals stored below the ruins of the WTC. As debris is removed, they're able to access parts of a 16-acre WTC basement. Precious metals are stored in numerous vaults within this area. The London Times says the quantity of these, quote, has been a carefully guarded secret. Further documentation to the New York Daily News, the London Times, the New York Times, and Reuters. The third and final report on this gold, November 2nd, 2001, Giuliani reduces numbers of firefighters at Ground Zero following recovery of gold. Giuliani angers firefighters when he decides to severely reduce the number of them that can search for remains at Ground Zero. Up to that point, 300 had been involved. Giuliani's decision meant that no more than 25 could be involved. This relates to what is called scoop and dump, that essentially, with the final removal of tens of millions of dollars of gold, silver, and other assets of the Bank of Nova Scotia that were buried beneath what was once the towers, once the money was out, Giuliani sided with the developers that opposed a lengthy recovery effort and ordered the scoop and dump operation so they could proceed with redevelopment. Further sources to MSNBC, Firefighting News, Bloomberg, and the Associated Press. And that, my friends, is 12 points of contention with the official story of 9/11. This is going to bring to a close the 140th episode of MediaMonarchy.com, celebrating the fourth anniversary of the website and remembering and investigating the events of 8 years ago today on September 11th, 2001. What we try and show you is the body of history. What we try and show you is that the right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing. I try and do the best job that I can for you. If you have your own points of contention with me, send me an email, mediamonarchy@yahoo.com or Gmail, and we'll take this further. You know this is important, my friends, and I thank you for being here through all of these important Media Monarchy broadcasts throughout this 9/11 weekend. Having said all that, I can say no more, my friends, other than thank you. And I implore you to get active or get radioactive. Take care.
Police would get him just the same.